Welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. Immigrantly family, some exciting news. We just launched a newsletter called Hyphenly. It's a space where immigrant stories live beyond the narrow lens of politics. It's about belonging, identity, culture, all the beautiful contradictions that come with them. So do me a favor, subscribe to Hyphenly for a dose of unapologetic reclamation of our identities. You can find the link in our show notes across all our podcasts. And now to today's episode with a comedian. Because honestly, we could all use more laughter right now. Derek Mitchell is the creator and performer behind Let's Double Dutch, a comedy show shaped by his life moving between the US, the Netherlands, and now the UK. Derek's work is hilarious, but what makes it special is how he uses humor to talk about culture clashes, displacement, and the subtle absurdities of living between worlds. Today, we are exploring how comedy can be a bridge and sometimes a battleground for identity. So without further ado, let's get right into it. As we were talking before recording, I love that you have all the equipment for this interview. It just made my day.
I am happy to hear that. I also like sound quality, and I brought this mic with me because I'm actually in a hotel in Brussels right now, but I brought it in like a big suitcase and just dragged it on a train with me.
Yeah, I heard that you are traveling, but where's home these days?
Amsterdam and London. I go back and forth a lot.
How long have you lived in Amsterdam?
I went there in 2012 for the first time.
So almost like 13 years.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself an expat or an immigrant?
An immigrant. That distinction is really interesting and fraught and also more complex, I think, sometimes than people think, because I think it more than anything has to do with like socioeconomics and class, and actually just like the difference between being brought over for a job that's like a middle class, high paying job or not. But it then bleeds into like social identity and all of those things. But I do a lot of shows for a lot of expats and also a lot of immigrants and also a lot of like European nationals. And it's really interesting to feel in the room, depending on like the dynamics of the audience, like where they have sensitivities around those kinds of terms.
So what have you noticed?
I mean, frankly, I think that like the most challenging or like painful or vulnerable elements of being a migrant, you're only actually aware of them if you're experiencing them yourself. And that's like how nationality works. Like you're only aware of your own nationality or the limitations of it or how it's coded where you are if you're other. If you're part of like the group that's like dominant or in charge of things or getting to call the shots, it's almost designed to become invisible to you, kind of. So I think people who are in like a more cocooned version of migration just aren't even aware of it. Like I don't think a lot of those people aggressively believe that like there's one right thing and one wrong thing. But I think a lot of them are just more like ignorant to maybe the things that are especially tricky for people who don't get to be part of that group.
Do you feel part of the dominant population in Amsterdam or the UK?
I definitely feel part of the dominant population in the UK, I would say, as like an Anglophone person. The challenging bits of being foreign as like a white American who sounds like I do in the UK are mostly like minor things. There are things that get to you over time.
Give me an example.
Oh, I mean, like language policing and like small microaggressive ways in which even the best English people with the best of intentions will just say things to you that like do just make you want to scream into a hand towel. Like, it really can make you think like, oh my God, like I would never, I don't like to think I would never say something like that to somebody. But it's also, again, coming from a place of like, they're actually not aware of like what that might do, or sometimes reminders that you don't belong there. But these are minor compared to the things that some people can experience. In the Netherlands, it's different. I mean, I'm much more of like a foreigner, I would say, there, but I'm also a Dutch citizen. Now I have like a passport. I went all the way, and I would say I actually care about that a lot. I was quite young when I left the US. Relatively speaking, I was like 16.
Oh, that's young.
And I went to an international school first, where I really feel like a little bit my like American national identity was broken down a little bit, almost as like a way to fit in, because everybody there was like internationalized in a way. It's not been cool to be an American, I think, on an international scale for a long time. But at that time, it just like wasn't stylish. I went there in 2010. I was there when like the Arab Spring was happening, and also when the United States captured and killed Osama bin Laden. And I remember like watching those news stories unfold with a lot of friends who were from Arab countries who were also like being internationalized. And I remember them just sharing like really interesting ways of like looking at that situation that I'd never heard of before. And I was suddenly so aware of how inculcated my like beliefs about like the gloriousness of the American imperial project were. Like, I was just suddenly aware of like, oh my God, like, this isn't good. I don't think this is all good. And I went to like a good, but like public American high school in the suburbs of Chicago, really good school, but like it was still a public school. Like, it was like government's, you know, approved curriculum. And still increasingly I reflect on that and just think like, oh, it was so like nationalistic. It was so, I was like indoctrinated to believe a lot of things that, again, you just take for granted. You don't question them. That's like how it's designed. But when I went there, I began to question them. And then, I mean, it was like a joke, and it's a joke for a lot of people. Like, Americans are loud and obnoxious and self-aggrandizing and overly enthusiastic. And I just like wanted to separate myself from that.
Your show, Let's Double Dutch, nods both to your time in the Netherlands and to the feeling of navigating two, in fact, three cultures at once. What does that phrase mean to you personally?
The phrase double Dutch comes from England in like the late medieval, early modern period, when there was a lot of like cultural and like trade-based contact between the Low Countries and England. And I think the Dutch language of that time, like Middle Dutch and Middle to Early Modern English, were much more mutually intelligible, I would say, than the modern versions of those languages are. And there was much more like linguistic bleed probably between Germanic languages, because like dictionaries weren't a thing that they were doing in like Northwestern European languages yet. There weren't as many like strict systematized ways of understanding language as like a nationalistic kind of project or framework. And so like the stereotype about Dutch was that it was hard to understand, but people could understand it, but it was hard. And so double Dutch means like nonsense language or gibberish, kind of colloquially. And I mean, what that shows is just like how when you grow up with anything, like a symbol or a tradition or a ritual or something that's like cultural, and everybody around you, you know, shows you like, this is important, this is a thing that we do, it becomes a part of you. And like, it becomes so like life or death important to you, even if it's something really silly, like a flag or like a dish or something like that. But if you didn't grow up with it, often it's gibberish, like it's nonsense language. But the immigrants, one of the major things you have to do on a cultural and social level is learn about why those things are meaningful, and like sometimes even pretend like they're meaningful to yourself when they're not actually.
So what have you learned about Dutch culture that you pretend is meaningful to you now?
King's Day, which is this big celebration that just happened, which is a national holiday to celebrate the king's birthday. I don't care about that. But it is fun, I guess. There's like big crowds of people and it's actually quite like communal and there's just like kids and families and you can like, everybody sells stuff in the street and there's like a tax forgiveness on that. So kids also will like sell like their books and stuff on the street. It's very like mercantile actually, which is like a big part of Dutch history, but it's also sweet. I mean, you learn to like find the things in it that you think are nice, but you'll never have that like that deep visceral sense of like, oh, this is a part of me. Like, I think I've come to realize you can't really force that to happen.
Oh, that's so interesting. And in some ways true. I've lived in the US for almost 20 plus years. And I still grapple with what I really truly believe in and what nationalistic aspirations I have as a Pakistani American having that hyphenated identity, right? But you bring up an important point. Moving to a new country, you've lived again in Netherlands for 13 years. When do you start to feel like you really belong? Do you think there is a timeline where you're like, ah, now I belong?
I mean, I think like in a very practical answer and in some ways like a really chilling one, I think is like, I genuinely felt like a bodied sense of relief when like legally I was settled and set. Like first when I had like my residency and then when I finally got my nationality, like I felt a calm about it all that I hadn't had before. Well, I mean, I think like, you know, also another thing in the show is that visas and passports and borders are all gibberish. Like they're things just like Europeans made up and then imposed on the world. And that's just like how we do things. But it's just like a human invention and it's a pretty...
It's psychological, right? You feel like, okay, now you've been given a nod to belong. It's somebody else authenticating your existence in that space.
Completely. And it's also like a profit-based scheme. Like it's insane how much money you have to spend. And I did this all as like a single person. I mean, I think about like families that are paying 3, 4, 5, 6 times the fees. It's a life's work sometimes that you're spending just to go somewhere, not for yourself, but for your children. And all of that like the emotional experience of it is not only like disregarded, it's intentionally erased from the process. And it's made to feel like this completely like draconian, like Kafka-esque, horrifying thing, basically to try to scare you away from doing it, I think, or to exhaust you and your resources in the process.
I want to go back to the languages. Now, you've talked about how language can be a barrier and a punchline. What's the most ridiculous language mix-up you've experienced living abroad?
Well, I guess in the Netherlands, language mix-ups... I mean, the Dutch language is just, to an English speaker, like a really... like funny sounding language because it sounds like a medieval version of English in like a funhouse mirror and it has all these weird sounds in it. I think to an English speaking ear, it just specifically sounds kind of like this goofy historical thing. But I guess like in terms of language mix-ups, well, there are interesting, like Dutch people also are really enthusiastic about English. They're proud that they speak really good English.
You're right. Dutch people that I have met, they have such good English. And sometimes I can't even tell the difference. Why is that?
An interesting thing about the Netherlands, I would say, within like European countries generally, is how fully they have embraced globalization. And I think partially like the history of the Low Countries as an entity that's like much older than like even nation states is just this like hotbed of like mercantilism and internationalism. It's always been like a really internationalized place. And the Dutch, unlike French people or Germans or Spanish people or Italians, where like there's such a pride in their languages, there's such a pride in their like cultures and the artifacts of those cultures, Dutch people almost have the opposite, where they like think Dutch is embarrassing, and they like would be so perplexed if you said you were trying to learn their language. And they also embrace foreign media a lot. They don't dub films except for kids. So like grown-ups watch things with subtitles in English. And so that's why there's Dutch people who have like a perfect American accent who've never been to the United States.
And that's really mind-boggling to me, because I can understand knowing a language, right? I grew up in Pakistan. It has two official languages, Urdu and English. I grew up speaking English, but I have an accent. What's fascinating to me about Dutch folks is they don't even have that other accent. They have like the American, whatever that means, accent, right? Because America itself has so many different accents, but the quintessential American accent.
Yeah, the media accent, the movie star accent, kind of. Because you'll meet Dutch people and it's like, what's your favorite show? And they're like, I love The Sopranos. That's my favorite show in the entire world.
Tony Gabagool, Grandma. It's nothing but fat and nitrates.
Gabagool, over here.
I don't think there are probably as many French people who would say that.
Yeah. The kind of content that you produce is based on culture. I've posed this question to other comedians as well. There's a fine line between laughing at a culture and laughing with it. And it really turns me off if somebody laughs at a culture. Being from a different culture, of course. How do you strike the balance in your work? Or do you even care?
Well, as a comedian, I think probably you just have to be led by what you think is funny. And you hope that that reflects well on you. And there's definitely comedians that think things are funny that I don't. I'm led by that to now, because I agree with you. I mean, a big part of my audience are Dutch people. And I really have dedicated the last like 10 years of my life to not only learning the Dutch language, being in relationship. I'm now married to a Dutch person. Our whole language takes place in Dutch. I watch and consume a ton of Dutch film and television and theater and music. And there are so many ways in which like Dutch social like customs and stuff have become a part of who I am and my life and how I like to live my life.
Give me an example.
I mean, there's definitely like a real commitment to like frank, direct, and no bullshit expression of like how you're feeling. So like Dutch people, like if you meet up with somebody and you thought that was horrible, an American or an English person will say, we should do this again sometime, just to like get away. And Dutch people have this like famous like first experience when they're befriending or in a relationship with an Anglophone person often, who will say something like that. And they think, oh, so like when? And then they get ghosted. And it's like this crushing experience. Because in Dutch, you would only ever say that if you mean it.
Oh, they're similar to Pakistanis, that.
Is it similar?
Yeah, yeah. We are very blunt, sometimes in your face, honest in our feelings. It was an evolution for me to be kinder and sweeter in some ways.
Yeah. Where are you? Where do you live in the States?
New York. Which makes me feel at home, because New Yorkers are more direct. But that's what I like about New Yorkers, right? They're straightforward, direct. You don't keep guessing. Like, we used to live in Denver, Colorado at one point. And I kid you not, like, my husband and I were always confused as to what people really meant when they said something.
I think the further west you go, the more bullshitty people can get.
Yeah, and you're like, okay, what are they saying, actually? Like, we just had to translate it in our minds almost, right? Which was taxing, because you're like, oh, they're saying it, but do they really mean it? How did you adjust, though? Because you've lived your formative years in the U.S.
I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. I can't even stress enough that my upbringing, I was raised by and surrounded by people who were deeply not internationally facing at all. Like, nobody even had passports. It was all just kind of white, lower middle class, Midwesterners who were born and raised in the Midwest were all a few generations descended from like poor immigrants from Germany, Netherlands, the UK. And that was like my upbringing. And then I got an opportunity to go to this international school, and I kind of like engineered that myself because I always had this deep, like I just had this sense. I had this book from DK, that like children's science publisher. I think it's like an imprint of Scholastic. And there was this book, and it was like kids from all over the world, a picture of them in their home. And then it was like folk stories from where they came from and like pictures of these places. And I just remember like at a young age, just being like, just imagining like, oh, imagine if like that was my life. I could have, there are people who have a different life than this. And that was so provocative to me and not to anybody else around me. And I just remember thinking, you guys, this is a nice place. I have to leave. There has to be other stuff out there. I'm sure of it. So I'm going to go find it. You can stay if you want. I have to go. And that's like why I left. But that, you know, doesn't mean that those adjustments weren't like sometimes so painful and like shocking. And the early days of that Dutch directness. When I went to international school, there was a Dutch student there and she was really nice. And like the first day I remember being like, because my mom's family are Dutch American, but not, they don't speak any Dutch. They're all like in many, you know, a lot of immigrant migration patterns, like then when a community happens, like the artifacts and the symbols they cling to of the original culture are frozen in time from when the first people came. So like the Dutch American community in the Great Lakes region of the United States, which is quite big, there's a place in Michigan called Holland. They don't speak Dutch. They were all like really poor immigrants from Groningen and Zeeland, two provinces in the Netherlands that went there around like from the 1860s to 1890s. And so like all of their symbols of Dutchness are from that time. They love like porcelain with like blue paint. It's called Delft's Blau, and they love little cookies with cinnamon, but it's all very Victorian and old fashioned. And that's their Dutch culture. And so I said to this woman at that time from the Netherlands, I was like, oh, I'm Dutch. And she was like, oh, really? Where are you from? And I was like, oh, I'm from Chicago. And she's like, oh, then you're not Dutch. And I was just like so shocked, like my American sensibilities. I was so offended and hurt by that. And now I look back and I think, no, she was just being honest. I wasn't.
Yeah, but that was cruel though.
It is a bit cruel, but she didn't mean it to be. That wasn't her intention. It's lost in translation.
That's lost in translation, right? You just have to almost code switch. But you're right. It's like the Dutch have moved on.
Mm.
But the descendants of them living in the US are clinging on to those artifacts and those nostalgic expressions of where they've come from. I love it. I love it. It's so fascinating to me. What was the most challenging part of adjusting to that bluntness?
I think just like actually realizing about myself that probably for personal reasons and also cultural reasons, like the judgments of other people or my perceived judgments from other people were like my North Star in telling me about my own worth and my own value. And I think like Americans are like really victim to that a lot, because it's sort of like there's such a culture in America of like, you got to be a winner. And if you're not a winner, you're a loser.
And you have to be a good person.
Yeah.
You have to be. Like I've heard so many people say things like, but I'm a good person. And I'm like, yeah, we are all a mix of good, bad, mean, kind. Our identities, our personalities are fluid. I mean, ideally, I would like to be a good person, but I don't consider myself to be a good person. I'm human. That's messy.
Yeah, and it's also very individualist in a way. It's like, there's much less of an emphasis, I would say, in like the moral education and like a sense of like civic duty and ethics in America. There's increasingly, I think this has also probably changed through the 20th century into the 21st century. I think nowadays there's much less of an emphasis on being a good community member in the United States, much less of an emphasis on like the transformative power of collectivity I think that like being a good person is about being an individual. And also what then gets erased is like how by being an American, you're also participating in something that has done great things and also continues to do horrifying things. And like Americans aren't good at holding space for that kind of stuff. It all happens in terms of absolutes of like good and evil.
Yeah, because there's a contradiction to that, right? The idea, the experiment itself is such an interesting idea. The society, the country, right? But then if there is a contradiction, how do you hold space for that? Even for immigrants like us, like we've really bought into the idea of America being this great experiment, which to some extent it is. But then there are contradictions that we need to hold. But going back to what you were saying, the challenges that you face, like in that adjustment period, right? Adjusting to that culture. You said being good, having that American mentality. What else?
I mean, I'm like a workaholic. And that was modeled to me by all of the grown-ups in my life. And I think American understanding and attitude about work, about like time off, about rest, about wellness, and like deep wellness, not like commercialized wellness, but like actually just like sitting outside and like prioritizing that, like, you know, and having access to that even, which a lot of people in like big urban areas in the United States don't even have. Like all that stuff I learned about more in Europe, and that was really good. And it's like actually sometimes still a source of like conflict in my marriage to a Dutch man who understands way better like what a holiday can be and should be.
Give me an example of how holiday is different for you versus your spouse.
Well, we didn't go on vacation when I was a kid, really. My grandparents lived in Michigan and they lived near on a beach. And so we would go there for weekends in the summertime. And then I would go to like scout camp for a week in the summer. I think we went to Disney World twice in my childhood. Those were the trips we went on. And while we were there, my dad was always like on his BlackBerry, sending emails on the phone. He was also chronically ill. And so I think he used work as like a survival mechanism. So there was like a lot going on there. My grandfather was like the same way. He was from a very, very poor family and community in Chicago. He was born in the 1930s. And he kind of was the first one who like, in a very like neoliberal bootstrapsy way, like pulled himself up and out and was very like proud of the life he created for us all and his children and grandchildren, as he should have been. But his relationship to work was also absolutely crazy. He worked himself to a point that I think he had MS and Parkinson's diagnosed later in life. And like neurologists and doctors said, like there's a strong case to be made that that can be because of like long-term stress and like, poor health kind of. So I was like surrounded by that. And I reached for my phone. I have like a lot going, which is great. We went to France after I did a festival, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival last August. And I was like still on my phone while we were there. And it's like embarrassing. And then like, Tim's like, what are you doing?
I mean, again, I'm just being devil's advocate here. Some may classify it as good work ethic.
It is that too.
How did you like France?
I liked it. I mean, we were in the south of France in a pretty remote area. So
not Paris.
No, I have been to Paris. I did some shows in Paris in December. That was also fun. I do like France. I would love to like learn French. That's the next language I'd like to commit.
Oh, how many languages do you know?
Not really that many. I mean, I speak Dutch fluently and my Spanish is pretty good, but like really rusty.
I went to France a couple of years ago. I think the timing wasn't right. I went in June and I did not like it. I was in Paris and I was like, oh, this is no fun. And we were in Amsterdam before that. And I loved it. Except for bikers. I mean, I was biking. I kid you not, I was. But people were aggressive and they were so pissed at me because I was a tourist biking like a tourist, which they did not appreciate at all.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be like the equivalent is if you were in New York City and you had a rental car that had a sign on it that says, I'm a tourist. The honking and the aggression would probably be off the charts.
And the funny thing is, I am an aggressive driver.
You probably
at times.
Have to be, right?
I have to be, especially in New York City. But with biking, I was like, leave me alone. I'm just enjoying.
It is nice. When I'm in London for a long stretch, which is much more like New York, and it's like scale and pace and like kind of how exhausting it can get after a while. Whenever I get back to Amsterdam, I always like get on my bike, especially if the weather's nice, and love to just like bike somewhere. And then the first time you almost get like hit by somebody, that's when you remember like it's not actually for pleasure.
It's not the same, right? Derek, what part of your identity feels most constant no matter where you go?
Probably like being a performer and a comedian and an artist.
Talk to me about that.
I mean, that's like what I really love to do. I always have had that. I always knew that. And I went like really far afield to like find my way into doing that. Like, I mean, I come from the United States and arguably one of the biggest like showbiz cultures and industries in the world. And there's so many people in Europe who like all they want is to go to Hollywood and they can't. And now especially it's impossible for them to go to the States. And so the fact that I like went to Europe to like kind of pursue that, though I was like also lost and searching, it's just like funny, but that's what I kind of live for.
What's the upside of going to Europe to learn or to do comedy?
Well, I guess in a sense, like, I mean, what I do as a comedian and as an actor is like build characters, I would say. And I'm led by like finding the ways that like they speak and like move and exist in their bodies. And I think that the way that I do that now is absolutely a result of like having gone further afield culturally and learned languages and studied like ways of speaking and accents and things like that. And if I had not done that, I probably wouldn't have the same tools in my toolkit. I'm glad I did it the way I did.
Are there jokes that hit in London but land differently or not at all in Amsterdam or New York?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm really excited to do these shows in the United States because, and this is like a comedy insight around these topics we're talking about, is that like one thing that I think almost all comedy makes use of in one way, shape, or form is cultural nostalgia. If you just like look at any comedian, a section of all their punchlines that they do or like stories that they tell or whatever hinge on some shared experience or thing or like brand name that's like a shorthand for something that we all know and we're all a part of that and we laugh out of like identification and also because what they've said is like a clever observed thing usually. When that's gibberish to you, it's not funny. Like, sometimes you can learn, and I experienced that so much in the UK, because that's where I really became a comedian. Like, I really was like gigging on like the open mic circuit in London and stuff before anything was happening. And I would be at these gigs with these like British comedians from all over the UK who would just be like killing, and they would just be saying these things. And I was like, I don't know what that is that you're saying. Like, all the words you're saying, we're both speaking English, but I don't know what you're talking about. But the people in this room absolutely love it. They are living for it. And I have to research this. And at this point, you know, because I've also been active and kind of living in the UK for about 10 years too, because I went there to study and then I've always had a foot there since. I've learned most of the references, but I don't like find them funny in the same way as certain of the things from America that I just grew up with and live in like...
Even now.
I mean, I can appreciate them more, but that visceral thing, like nobody decides to laugh. If you decide to laugh, you sound like a crazy person. You laugh because there's something in you that like taps into like a visceral, like almost animal thing where it's like the joy that sweeps over you is like something you can't even suppress. And it's, you don't decide that. And so like, it can be so minor. And it's also down to like the poetry of like how comedy works. You know, TJ Maxx, big store in the United States, punchline probably that a lot of comedians make use of because it's like a funny store that we all go to, but like what the hell is going on there? Like, why do they sell pesto? Like all of these things. There's like fun stuff with TJ Maxx. In the UK, the same store exists, but it's called TK Maxx. If the punchline is TK Maxx, I'm kind of brought out of it in a way because I'm like, oh, that's the British version of TJ Maxx. But if the punchline is TJ Maxx, I'm there. You know what I mean? It's so subtle.
Yeah, you're right. But even I think the way comedy is structured in America, it's very self-deprecating. But in the UK, it's different. It's more dry. I don't know how to explain it. It is dry, right?
Dryness is such a good word, I think. And wit. Wit is also like a big part of it.
Well, yeah, it's more witty, right? I grew up, my dad loves British comedy. So I grew up with that.
So listen, what can I get you two? How about a foot of wine?
Can I get a meter of vodka with an inch of tonic?
Come on, Mark, turn it on, play the game.
Naughty, you've combined metric and imperial. You might get an interdenominational, you know, from mixing the two measurement systems, a hangover of that kind.
And to your point, he would laugh, he enjoyed it. I never understood it. I do understand American comedy more.
Speaking of kids, wait, new data shows that middle school students have only made up a third of the math skills they lost during the pandemic. Their math was so bad, they didn't get it when I texted them, U plus me equals 69.
I'm always somebody who I'm drawn to character. And the Brits can be very, very good at this, too. There are some British comedians that I think are the best of the best. But I mean, like, the first comedian I ever loved and as a small child was Robin Williams.
1 teaspoon cumin.
1 cumin. Knock, knock, cumin. A very old Indian joke. Knock, knock, cumin.
Yeah, you got it. I am. Right.
And he blended stand-up and storytelling and characters and voices and all of that. And he's one of, like, the best ever. Also, Whoopi Goldberg.
I shouldn't talk that way about the day, should I? No. Well, they tell you, you mustn't say nothing about the dead unless you could say something good. He dead, good.
And she would play characters too, and she was like in films and stuff. That was what I was always drawn to. And I also watched a lot of SNL. My parents were, like, loved Saturday Night Live. And so I think like sketch that is character-led, because British sketch often is much more, revolves around like chasing down a concept and finding all of the possible ways in which to play on our expectations or words and wordplay and to like subvert things in a kind of ingenious, clever way. And I do think sometimes to a fault, SNL is often just about like, how can we play a character that's as like goofy and silly and like fun as possible? Sometimes to the detriment of the sketch, like having much form or like purpose.
How's it hanging? I'm David Pumpkins, and I'm gonna scare the hell out of you.
Why do you say at the detriment of?
Well, I think any kind of performing art, like you're dealing with a few dials. So you're dealing with character and pathos and humor and structure and storytelling and like all of these things. And you can't have them all cranked up. Like for it to work, it has to be a negotiation. And those can be sometimes culturally determined as well. And I think that's what it sounds like that's what you're hitting at too. And I completely agree that like witty dryness, which I think also is alive, not just in British comedy, but also in continental, like Dutch comedy, which is great, even though there's a stereotype that Dutch people aren't funny. But I think that's mostly one held by people who don't speak Dutch and like don't get to hear Dutch people speak their own language. It's very dry and like observational and wry and kind of sarcastic. And
this makes me think of you as an artist, what you feel and how comfortable or where you feel most creatively at home versus where you feel more culturally at home. Is there a difference?
I think they are related. I do think they're related. You know, what's interesting is like my audience for Let's Double Dutch, both online and at live shows, and I've been touring now for like a year and a half, kind of nonstop. I've done like hundreds of shows in the last year and meet a lot of people. And I always kind of am engaging with the audience during the show. And there is very little that every single person shares in common beyond usually having some link to internationalism, international identity, and possibly some tie to Dutchness, but not even that always. And so it can be a very rewarding thing to connect with all of those people at once, seeing as we, in theory and on paper, actually sometimes have very little in common. But sometimes it can also be a bit of like a lonely thing, because like there will be a moment when like, you know, if it's going somewhere and it's fun, and then I know like, oh, this reference, this would be perfect. Like that is exactly what this is. And I know that if I was doing this right now in London, or if I was doing this right now in New York, people would love it. But I'm not in those places right now. And I know they will not know what I'm talking about. And sometimes I still go for it anyway. And it's confirmed. They've never heard of this before. And it can be such like an interesting thing. And I'll see clips of like comics doing things that I think are so brilliant. And then I'll just think, I could like not make that joke with this audience. Like I could never make that joke, even though that feels like it's so my like language of like what's funny. Like I love it so much. And I could never in a million years do that for the audiences at the shows that I'm doing right now. But, you know, that's just one of many parameters on like creative work. And there's no artist who exists free of those kinds of parameters. That's just like a part of the job.
You know, it's so interesting to me as I'm listening to you as a comedian, how important it is for you to have that audience affirmation. Right? Because you are introducing something new, and yet if they don't find it palatable and if it doesn't land, are you persistent? Have you ever been persistent in, okay, this is not landing, but I know it's good, it's great, and I'll keep doing it till they get it?
Yeah, sometimes. I think that's part of just the work of it. It's like developing, and it's a long game. Like becoming good at comedy. I don't know who said this. Some famous comedian said it takes 20 years to become a good comedian. It takes 10 years to find your voice, and then it takes 10 more years to understand how to use it properly. And I think that's probably right. I've been at it now for 10 years, so there's probably 10 more to go before I'm actually good.
So how do you see yourself as a comedian right now in this moment?
I mean, it depends on the night. Sometimes I finish a show and I think, wow, that was a 10, really knocked out of the park. Sometimes it's a 1. I mean, it can vary pretty widely. I think the thing that makes you, when it's just your job, which it now is for me, you actually just learn how to like leave that behind almost immediately, whether it's a 10 or a 1, because there's always another one coming really soon. And if you're clinging to that 10 or 1, you're going to like get in your own way, and it's going to make the next show probably not what it's supposed to be. Because actually, to what you were saying about the audience's like approval and that feedback, like comedy depends on instantaneous feedback from the audience, but you have to figure out some way to not let that be where you derive your like self-worth from. And it can be really hard. And there are some times when, unfortunately, you accidentally do let it determine your self-worth. But if you did all the time, you would, I think, actually go insane. Like, I think it would kill you.
What's the difference between seeing comedy as a job versus as passion? And can they coexist?
Yeah, they can. I think they should coexist. But there are elements of both of those camps that you do have to keep in mind. So, if it's just a passion, then I think it can overwhelm everything. And then it becomes like all consuming. And what the audience thinks about you then like determines how you feel when you wake up in the morning or go to bed at night. And it shouldn't. So that's why it's important also to remind yourself that it's a job and that you need to be able to leave it behind sometimes. But if you're not passionate about it, then it'll become soulless and heartless. And any artist can hit that wall. To me, I think probably I believe you just have to try really hard to stay engaged, to remind yourself and to not like lose sight of like why it is that you're so passionate about it.
How do you stay engaged?
I watch a lot of comedy, I mean, most of the people in my life are comedians or actors or artists. And I feel grateful that I, you know, I have ideas that keep coming. So I always have stuff I want to keep working on.
Have you ever thought of expanding your friend circle to have more content? Maybe if you had like finance bros or other people as your friends, you would have more interesting content?
I don't know about finance bros. there are some finance bros in my life, actually.
I don't know. I think they are somehow they would lend so much content for comedy. I don't know why I think that. Maybe I live in New York and that's the first thought that came to mind.
There are finance bros in my life that I work with. I mean, I'm sure there's some great finance bro comedy accounts out there. That's almost certainly a niche that's already been filled. No, you make a good point. I mean, I think like diversifying the kinds of people you have around you is a good idea.
So you're coming to the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is very exciting. Tell us about your tour.
So I'm coming to New York, Chicago, and L.A. at the end of May. I've never performed comedy in the United States before.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm very excited. I'm also like, it's not a great time for America. I'm a bit stressed about it a little bit. I just don't know what I'm going to be. I mean, my family's also in Chicago. I mean, my mom is like beside herself, I think, with some of the stuff that's going down in government and everything right now. But I just hear these, I'm not worried about myself, but just the thought of like the borders and everything, and in light of everything that's going on right now and how much people are hurting and how there are so many like communities in America that I think probably every day are like, what's going to happen to us? Like, I don't know. I mean, it just feels like I have my work cut out for me, which is to like make people laugh. And there will be immigrants in the audience who are going through any number of things. And I'm just like, whoa, the stakes feel higher than... I'm also touring right now in the UK, and the stakes feel a little bit lower there than they do in the United States.
Derek, in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do it?
I think I would define the United States of America as... Oh, God, that's hard. I think for me personally, kind of for myself, probably like a complicated mix of home and like strangers or like alienation or like unknown. Yeah, a combination of home and unknown. I think that's it.
I like that. Where can people go and get tickets for your tour?
Tickets are all linked in my socials bios at Let's Double Dutch on Instagram, TikTok, Threads, Facebook, and YouTube. And the shows are going to be at Second City, New York in Brooklyn, at Zany's Rosemont in Chicago, and at Dynasty Typewriter and the Lyric Harperion in Los Angeles. And so you could also just book through those venues website.
Wonderful. And we'll also link it in our show notes. This was so good. I had a lot of fun talking to you.
Thank you so much. I had a great time talking to you too. Thank you.
I'm so glad I got to interview Derek. I am going to watch his show. So please buy your tickets. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it, especially these days, right? We all need more comedy. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrant Leap theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when we have another important conversation. Take care.